Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. My name is Ernesto.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Jim. So, Jim, just a reminder, we have at least three members who are will be absent: Mark, Marianne, and Tisha.
Okay, quorum is seven.
Could be. Let me count. And one, two, three, four, five.
One, two, three, four. We got five right now, so we need two more.
Yes, correct.
It's only 4 o'clock, and this is Tucson time, so.
And another reminder, Jim, Anne will be in at around 4:30. So move agenda items up.
Okay, yeah, so we'll agenda item number 4 and 5 we'll push down. You know, actually, I think Anne needs to be involved in 6 and 7 as well. So, move up 8 through 11. Ray is in the waiting room.
I see her.
Let's see, Tiara, Stefan, and Victoria. Are in the chat. I'm not sure why the video audio isn't working.
We still need one more to make quorum.
Yep. There's somebody who's trying to get in, but the video nor audio is working for them. I have no remedy for that. And Tiara Stefan, she's still working at it. Good.
Well, let's see here. So Marianne, I know, is out of town. Mark is out of town. And Tisha
has a conflict with the meeting.
So Ray is here. Kenny and is on the agenda. So hopefully he'll be here. I haven't heard from Shay. Vicky hasn't been on a meeting for a while. She's missed like the last three, I think, hasn't she?
That's a good question. Rachel might know.
Hi, Mindy. I'm not sure about Vicky's attendance. I think Neto had told me that last month that she had a reason to be out, but I'm not sure for this month.
Right, she had she had an excuse last month.
Right.
Okay. So
Anesia. Hi, Kenny.
So I count seven commissioners, Jim. How many do you count?
Two, three, four, five, six, seven. Okay, yeah, we've got quorum. Hey, before we start, Neto, meeting minutes didn't come out, did they, from last month?
Yes,
I don't remember seeing them. Okay. They're not on the webpage. Did anybody else receive them?
No.
Okay.
They're on the website.
They are?
Let me check. Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Okay, let's get started.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, is the recording going?
Yes.
Okay, the Commission on Equitable Housing Development meeting is now commenced. It is September 7th at 4:05 p.m. This meeting is being held virtually due to COVID-19 to allow for social distancing and to protect the public health. As we continue our efforts in meeting remotely, we ask all commissioners and guests to mute yourself until called upon to speak to avoid feedback and background noise. For those who have dialed in using the call-in number to unmute, dial *6 on your phone. Also, prior to speaking, please announce who you are to identify yourself. As a reminder, this meeting is being recorded. We ask that you only use the chat function to request to speak or to announce that you're leaving the meeting so we can track quorum. Also, to comply with the state open meeting law, attendance and votes will be done by way of roll call using audio, not using the chat function. Okay, so roll call, Maggie Amato-Tez.
Present.
Wendy Asher. Is absent. Marianne Beerling's absent. Mindy Bernstein?
Here.
Mark Clark is absent. Vicky Casino is absent. Sharia Jimenez is absent. Lori Mazurbo?
Here.
Tisha Tallman is absent. Jim Toffel, I am here. Ray Winch?
Here.
Kenny Wong?
Well, I'm here.
And Jay Young?
Here.
Okay, so let's see here. Wendy, Marianne, Mark, Vicky, Shay, and Tisha. Okay. Okay, we're going to have to skip agenda item number 2 because the meeting minutes have not been released. Agenda item number 3 is the call to audience. This is a time when any member of the public may address the Commission on Equitable Housing and Development. Due to time constraints, the total time allocated for this is 15 minutes. Individuals are allowed 3 minutes each. Due to open meeting laws, commission members cannot discuss topics that are not on the agenda. Items brought up by the public may be considered as an agenda item for future meeting. So I see we have one person who'd like to speak, Victoria.
Give me a minute. Okay, Victoria.
All right. I've been working on a master case management document, and I've been making phone calls, and my biggest concern is there's not transparency with the numbers and resources that are given to the homeless, so they actually cannot figure out where to go, what to do. I've role played. And found out that it's completely unattainable and traumatizing for individuals because they'll be sent around to different things, and this includes 211. So we need to reboot that as soon as possible, especially if you're hoping to work with people who are trying to avoid becoming homeless. And my biggest concern is new beginnings It seems to be a family shelter, and I got conflicting messages about that from various phone numbers. And Salvation Army seems to have 3 to 4 different phone numbers and 2 different addresses. So I've been working really hard on making something that's updated, can be updated, and is better than the current resource document of Pima County or anything that has been sent to me by others. So that has been taking a lot of time, including the numbers, addresses, and informations about slumlords and low-income housing that's naturally affordable. And my biggest concern is that we have made progress in one area with the homeless courts that did not exist when I was struggling with slumlords. And soundly, we have a next step. That next step is to look at behaviors of slumlords, how they register, how they work, what their paperwork looks like. And my concern is safety around that, because these people have been operating and fighting against the same lawyers with Southwest Legal Aid. And they know who I am because I am part of the system. So the conflict is a bit personal, since I've lost everything and had to start over a couple of times. And I think it would be very important to bring this before the judge and work with lawyers from the universities who have different lawyer groups that are related around movement lawyers, which is a type of lawyering, and look at if we can address these issues in our city a little bit better and take stock and possibly take back, if needed, any property that is being abused or misused. So that's been my biggest issue. I'm still working on making my case, which is a step-by-step process. And then I'll be making public comment at every level in every area and involving myself heavily, so you'll hear from me. But I'll be recording and snipping and organizing and keeping this as my job that I do while I'm on Social Security living in low-income housing. So that's me, the People's Copywriter Project. Thank you.
Thank you, Victoria. Okay, Joe.
Thank you, everybody. I wanted to make a note of something. As this body talks about different regulations and things that can be done at the city and county and state level for our housing. One of the things that happened recently was New York City put in some laws about short-term rentals, Airbnbs and such. And they went into effect on September 5th, and we have the first numbers provided by a group that monitors Airbnbs called Inside Airbnb. From the last month to now, there's been a 70% drop in Airbnb short-term rentals in New York City. About 4,000 of the long-term rentals haven't been converted to anything yet. The listings were deactivated on the short-term rental section of Airbnb, and it looks like the majority of the rest of them are being converted to long-term rentals. So I'm not sure if anybody would be interested in looking into those regulations and what New York City did as far as making people register those and things like that. But it seems like that is a step forward for them as far as getting some more long-term rentals on the housing market. So might be something worth looking into via CHD, or if city staff might be interested in that. But it seems like a big step, and it sounded pretty cool. I wanted to bring it up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe. Anybody else would like to speak?
I do not see any other hands.
Okay. So without objection, Anne is in the attendee list now. So.
And Vicky's coming in.
Okay. Hey, Anne.
Hello.
Hi. Do you, so we just got through the call to audience. Are you ready to talk about the housing financial stability plan, or do you need me to put it off for a little bit?
I'm ready if you're ready.
Okay, well, let's stick with the agenda then. So agenda item number four is the public housing financial stability plan.
Thank you, Jim, and hello, good afternoon, evening, everyone. So I wanted to give you a heads up and talk to the commission and get feedback from you all. We are starting public outreach in regarding our public housing portfolio, and we're going to mayor and council, and it's actually the Public Housing Board of Commissioners, not next week, but the week after, September 19th. And so I wanted to get feedback from you all first that I can incorporate into my presentation to mayor and council in a couple weeks, and really wanted to start this dialogue. So given your expertise and given the focus on the commission, I really feel like, ooh, and I do thank you, Ernesto and folks who are working, can you please make sure Eric Novak is made a presenter? So wanted to share with you a plan. I know materials went out. I am going to actually do a short presentation because I really want to hear feedback on sort of the best way to communicate about what it is I'm talking about. I also want to introduce Eric Novak, who was just made a presenter and is now on camera. So you'll hear in my presentation, the city and our public housing authority is learning how to use some HUD tools, and we have contracted with Praxis Consulting Group, and that's Eric Novak is here. I feel like as a concept, this idea is fairly simple, but when you start looking at the details and sort of what it all involves, it gets really complex and detailed quickly. So if there are questions or if I say anything, Eric can jump in. But I am going to share my screen. Okay, really going to share my screen, I swear. Okay, you can see it. Okay. Let me also close my door as I hear folks. Okay. I am calling this our public housing financial stability plan. And so, and this is where I might actually ask Eric to jump in to help me out here. So what Eric and his team, they have a lot of experience with public housing authorities and public housing nationwide. And one thing that I really appreciate that he pointed out about the Tucson public housing portfolio is really just how unique it is, how intentional it has been, and really how we've been on the front end of new HUD tools and different types of financial mechanisms to make our housing better. And so, for instance, the MLK apartments, if you've been in there, that was done about 10 years ago, a little over 10 years ago now, and it's an incredible low-income housing tax credit project that is also public housing. And so that's an example of a pretty complex process that led the city to do that project. And one thing I really want to ground the conversation in is that the city of Tucson, our mayor and council and HCD, we have continued to try to take steps to increase the housing that the city owns, recently created the development arm, I would say HCD and mayor and council right now are firmly committed to owning affordable housing, increasing the number of units, and really this whole idea of
repositioning our public housing is more to make sure that we have the resources to be able to sustain our units moving forward, make sure they're high quality, and also to grow units over time. So that isn't changing, this idea of repositioning public housing. We are committed to housing for low-income populations. And one challenge we have is that our public housing portfolio is not sustainable as is. If we were to continue to own and operate our public housing like we do today, we will continue. We have a little bit of a reserve right now, but we are draining our reserve. And so eventually at some point, we need to figure out different tools. And every public housing authority across the country is in the same position, where the majority of them, and Eric can speak to this better than I can, he's worked in a lot of these communities, the majority of them have already undertaken this repositioning process. So they're further along in repositioning their public housing than we are. And so wanted to mention that even in Arizona, Phoenix, Maricopa County, Chandler, Flagstaff, we're all in the same position where we're all working on this asset repositioning of our public housing. And so HUD itself recognizes public housing is not a sustainable model anymore. All of the public housing throughout the country is getting older and is in need of much more investment. And yet the money we're given from HUD is not increased enough to take care of the need when it comes to both the physical infrastructure and then also the operations. And then I do want to mention, I mentioned this word scattered site, and am interested in sort of the easiest way to explain this. Really, a uniqueness to our housing, public housing portfolio is how many single family homes we have scattered throughout Tucson. And that was intentional. I really appreciate this idea of putting housing in higher wealth areas and really sort of tucking the public housing into neighborhoods. So I absolutely realize that was intentional and really want to kind of talk through some of that with you all. And I am going to let Ray jump in here because I have a feeling I will appreciate what they're thinking here.
Thank you, Anne. I just had a question about the assumption of public housing not being a sustainable housing program. And some is, I very much see that it's not being sustained, and it's not being sustained with the funding that's being provided. And wonder if the part of the research has been, what would it take for the city of Tucson, at least to be supplementing so that it was something that we could fund? And maybe some of that isn't possible, but just looking at some of the spreadsheets, I was like, oh, some of these are like $500 a unit a year for the maintenance. I was like, I might be reading those wrong, but I was like, is some of that we actually could be,
yeah.
I mean, that we're underfunding it as a city as well, and how could we be making that commitment towards public housing?
And I appreciate that. So the question is sort of, what would it take for to stay sustainable as public housing? And I do think let's get to that question when we see a couple slides that I think will help articulate where we're at. And I'll also ask Eric to probably jump in here in terms of thoughts there. But I do want to kind of show some of the numbers that can help highlight why I'm saying today it's not sustainable with this model and why we are looking at repositioning. Yeah, no worries. No, it won't let me. There we go. I want to, and so we've known this is coming. This is something that Liz Morales started years back, and probably even her predecessor was looking into this, but we knew that we would have to be looking at the repositioning tools. And so I will say we intentionally added this into the housing affordability strategy in terms of the number one policy. We called it transform public housing. And I sort of almost regret using that word because I would say more preserve and stabilize public housing, you know, to sort of the idea to preserve and stabilize our housing assets moving forward. And so these were some of the actions we included in HAST under that item. One thing in terms of what I'm asking the commission for today is feedback and thoughts and things to consider. Even when I go to mayor and council in a couple of weeks, all we're asking for is the same feedback, discussion, consideration, and approval to move forward with some of the short-term recommendations that Eric's team has made. And we'll talk through that. But each and every unit, there is a process to get approval to reposition the units, you know, into the projects. And so each project that we go through reposition involves evaluating the condition and sort of other aspects of that unit to see what tools are available and would make sense. And then also getting resident input, and we want to get community input too. Some of these decisions do, I think, impact more than just the immediate residents. And so we want to hear folks like the commission and other stakeholders. And then very grateful for Eric and his team really creating viable financial plans and really thinking through where to get the financing for some of these projects. And then Public Housing Authority, which is also mayor and council plus a resident, we would need to take it back for approval for that project. And ultimately, we submit it to HUD, who gives us an approval. And we'll talk through, and I'll ask Eric to help me here. One of the first ones we look to move forward with is MLK. A really awesome housing complex, and we can sort of talk through what that looks like with a real life example. I mentioned we've hired Eric and his team because we put out an RFP for firms that specialize in doing this and really creating these plans for HUD. Eric's team came out here and inventoried our portfolio, talked to our staff, looked at the units and really tried to get a good sense of what our public housing looks like. They're going to help train us a little more on these tools. And ultimately, they did draft the strategy that you have a link to, the draft strategy and the draft executive summary that tried to summarize that very large document in a very succinct summary. Also, in terms of when I talk about public housing, I wanted to give you a summary of what that looks like for Tucson. So we have 1,505 public housing units today. People have often heard us talk about our El Portal portfolio, and I want to make sure it's clear that we're not talking. El Portal is a separate portfolio that is not federally subsidized. So in addition to our public housing, we do own more units. Overall, we own about 2,000 units, but our public housing portfolio, in which HUD gives us money, operating money and some capital money, we have 1,505. Some of them are multifamily sites, but a significant number, and that number varies and there's many reasons for that. We're thinking somewhere in the ballpark of 450, 500 are single family homes. And a little more than that are scattered site units. Here is a map showing where those units are. So I mentioned many of them are scattered throughout Tucson. Again, that was intentionally done. And on one hand, absolutely appreciate the intentionality. And I will say today, it's a real challenge for us to have that many rental units that far away from where our main offices are. And even our, we have some offices that are closer, but no matter what, our housing techs are in a car driving quite a bit to fix homes. And then those homes have different appliances and different systems than all the other homes in our portfolio. So thinking about being a landlord and owning and operating that many single family homes is really challenging to us. And in terms of thinking about our greenhouse gas emissions and transportation being the largest climate contributor, greenhouse gas contributor, it's something that I'm really mindful of. Scattered sites, I feel like I need to figure out a way to simplify how to talk about this, but we do talk about what's eligible for certain tools under scattered sites. And so this is HUD's definition of what is a scattered site. So four or fewer units that are non-contiguous. And so that's where we have a little bit, we were talking throughout this time about what the numbers are. And it's just because in some cases we have a couple units next to each other and then there's a gap. And then we have a couple units next to each other. And so really figuring out the exact number is something that will take us more time. We're estimating somewhere in the ballpark of 500 scattered sites units, and the tools and our strategy for those would look different than the tools and strategies for our multifamily. And so getting back to Ray's question, I want to sort of give a sense of what it would take. And it's really hard to do that. We did a physical needs assessment in 2019. And I will tell you, in 2019, in 2020, staff looked at the numbers and felt like it was way too low in terms of the estimated needs for our units. And then enter pandemic and construction costs and labor costs skyrocketing. And I'm cautious to even share these numbers, and yet it's the best numbers we have right now. But what we know is it's significantly greater than what even we have. So based on what our estimate was and what we're getting, the idea is it would take us 18 years to address the deficiencies in our public housing. But I don't even want to guess what that is in reality. And so I think that I'm going to ask, and I'll share this too, and then I'm going to pause and let Eric jump in here. So operating, so that's on the capital end. Capital end, we know we're only getting a little bit of money from HUD each year to address the deficiencies. We'll take one of the recommendations is to move forward and assess Craycroft Tower. It's about a 70 unit property that needs a full rehabilitation. And so when you think about that property with 70 units and the resources it would take alone, it would be years before we could pull enough HUD capital to actually address the deficiencies at that site. So that's the capital side. And then the operating side, this past year, and I think that I'm hoping this is an anomaly, this is a high-end year, but we had a $4 million deficit in terms of what we were getting from HUD to operate our public housing and what we ended up paying for costs to operate. And I think this particular year was really on the extreme end with, we still were in a situation where we weren't collecting rent like we had been. So a lot of during the pandemic, a lot of rent being suspended. And then also the contracting costs, we try to do some maintenance in-house and we do contract a lot of our work out. And so that those costs have absolutely skyrocketed. Vicki, I appreciate this discussion here.
Well, I really wanted to say something, a couple of things, but about the scattered sites, I really appreciate that. From a disability perspective, you know, we don't like segregated housing, and that's what often happens for individuals with physical disabilities. So we always advocate for, accessible, affordable, integrated housing. And I was at two of your properties today. I don't know if they're within, I don't know if you know which ones I'm talking about. Ann, Liz had
San Antonio.
Yeah. What I loved was I drove right past them and didn't realize it. Like my GPS took me there and then it said, you've arrived. And so it wasn't readily apparent, like, this is the disabled housing, you know, integrated in the community. And, you know, so I had to turn around, and then I actually saw either Terry or Celine standing outside. So I knew which one it was. So I wanted to comment on that. And the other thing, this doesn't get at the biggest problem, but I did want to really do a shout out to your team on those two properties that I saw, and the accessibility improvements they're making for the tenants who are moving in, because you already have disabled tenants lined up. So my team has been working with your team and, you know, ensuring the access. And I feel like the city of Tucson is going above and beyond to ensure that accessibility and to meet the needs of those tenants coming in. But we also talked about some of the changes that were made based on our recommendations to improve accessibility. Really could benefit anyone. And so we talked a little bit about too, just, you know, not thinking about those as things that you would do just in for a disabled person, but, you know, like lever handled faucets, like those are things that can benefit everyone and also promote aging in place, and things like, instead of turn dials, to use little sliders for the fan and lights. And so some of those little things that really could become standard and promote more universal accessibility, rather than doing the remediation, you know, when somebody disabled is moving in. But anyway, I just really wanted to commend your team for, they're doing a really great job. Those two homes look absolutely beautiful.
Thank you.
I didn't see the before. I'm seeing them like they're almost done. And my staff had said, you know, I think when they first met with your team, the contractor was there too. And so all of the recommendations were taken and implemented. And now it's just a few minor things that need to be fixed. So I just wanted to definitely do that shout out to your team for that.
Thanks. And I appreciate that, and do think that that's an example of where, given the age of our portfolio, just thinking through making improvements for aging in place and persons with disabilities, the need is greater than we've been able to address. And so something that's mindful to me, glad that we were able to work on that with these projects, but there's so much need with so many of our other sites. Jim.
Hi. So I've got quite a few thoughts, but I'm in terms of the scattered housing, I think the reason that those costs are out of line with the multifamily is it's really hard to manage those properties. And what I mean by that is a typical apartment complex has a property manager. They do regular inspections. They go through each unit every month to change the filters and kind of keep an eye on what's going on.
And that filter is the same filter as that's used in the other apartments,
right,
that are all there.
Right. So there's a regular process, and everybody understands that, you know, that people are going to be coming in and doing those types of inspections. And you can't do that on the scattered housing. It's too much. And we did a project with the city of Mesa. Gosh, it's probably 16, 17 years ago. It was a Mesa scattered housing project, and they took their worst 40 units for their housing department, and they did a full rehab. And we were part of the capital needs assessment, and we did 100% walk list, you know, identified all the things that needed to change. And some of these units were, I mean, there was hoarders, there was people who had just tons of animals, there were plumbing leaks, some of the living conditions were just god awful. And so we went through and got the units really looking new again, all of them. And then when we went back through for the 1 year inspection, there was a good portion of them that were just as bad after 1 year as before the rehab, because so much of the maintenance is based on the living conditions of the tenants and their ability to, you know, to treat the units and the houses like they're their own. And if you don't have a property manager who's able to regularly do inspections and keep people accountable, it's near impossible to maintain those places properly. And so I mean, I'm not sure what the answer is. I know what the problem is. I don't know what the answer is. And, you know, I just think, you know, looking forward, you know, I would recommend if the city is intent on owning new properties, it's going to be much more efficient to do it, you know, in larger projects. You know, going back to your previous slide. So that's just a thought. Going back to this slide. Have you looked at doing 4% tax credits on these? Because I think those work really well on these types of projects.
So that's a good transition. I want to kind of move to where we're interested in going. And one thing I want to mention on the weighted average needs per unit, I want to make sure to be clear that that doesn't consider Tucson House, which is its own own large project in and of itself. And so, and on Tucson House, that's an exact example of getting the Choice Neighborhoods money will allow us to use the repositioning tools that HUD has available to us, use a 4% tax credit, use the tax credit mechanism, and be able to position it. And so now I'm getting out of my depth. I'm going to have Eric jump in and sort of explain how something like that works and how through asset repositioning, we can use some of the tools to support Tucson House. But I also am hoping, Eric, to get back to Ray's question on what it would look like. All right, thank you. I'm going to shush before we move on.
Do you want to get to those slides, Anne, or do you want to? I do want to mention on this slide that the capital needs per unit that we're showing, these are probably a third of the actual costs it would take just in hard costs to bring these units up to modern standards. So when we're doing renovation of public housing that's 40 years old, we're typically spending at least $125,000 a unit hard comp, and often it's more than that. And it's not just because you're bringing units up to modern standards, and these capital needs assessments don't really address that. But it's asbestos abatement. It's
excuse me, Eric. Hi. Your voice or the video is going in and out. I'm watching the closed caption, but I don't know if anybody else is experiencing that.
Yeah, you're breaking up, Eric.
Okay. Yeah, you're breaking up, Eric.
Okay. Can you, I'm not sure what, is it my earphones? Because I'm hearing people fine.
Did you call in or are you working through your computer?
Through my computer.
You might want to call in if you have that option.
Is there?
It could also be your earphones.
Let me try moving to wired earphones.
Hey, Ann, while we're on this, there's three projects here that are quite a bit newer than everything else.
Correct.
So, Silverbell and Posada Sentinel. I would guess that the capital needs requirements on those three are significantly below the others. Is that true?
It's actually not. Part of it is, you're hitting these projects right when, first of all, I can you hear me? And should I continue to try to move towards wired?
Thank you. You come a little bit in and out still.
Okay, let me try and I'm untangling. And why don't you keep on presenting and I will get
okay.
set up here.
So. And
I have closed caption on if that would help anybody else when Eric talks, if there's an issue.
Okay, I'll keep going. I don't,
it's not completely accurate though, because for the captioning to be accurate, you really need to speak very clearly. So it is difficult to catch.
Okay, I'll keep going and then we'll see if Eric, oh wait, hold on, he's close.
Yeah, can you hear me now? Is that better?
That is better.
Oh, good. Okay. Go back to the old technology. It's so much better. Some of the projects that are younger are reaching the end of their first cycle of, so they're 15 to 20 years old and everything is coming due on them. And so that's sort of captured by these capital needs assessments. I think the scatter site capital needs assessments that are here, they just did a sample of each. So there might've been, you know, for AMP 111, there are 184 units in that portfolio. They might've assessed 15 of them. And so it's not, you know, you have some of your scatter site are adobe single family homes with aluminum windows and swamp cooler, you know, cooling. And it's in the report, we talk about how much it would truly cost to bring those up to put in air conditioning cost $50,000 because you're not just replacing the HVAC system. You're having to put in new windows and insulation and electrical just to add the air conditioning and so on. So it's that's why that these costs just sort of severely understate what the actual need is for this portfolio.
Okay, I'll move forward on what we are proposing, and then we'll ask Eric to jump in more in terms of what it would take to do these projects and sort of what it would take to do them in a way that keeps them public housing and sort of why, what these tools are aimed to do. So I've already kind of touched on this, the reasons in which we're interested. I want to address our aging public housing and make sure that what we have in our portfolio is high quality and at least has some of the more modern, maybe not 2023 top of the line, but at least is a decent, safe home for the people living in our housing. I want to make sure sustainably for the future, our finances, we can continue to own and operate and develop and have enough housing for the future, but really make sure financially we have enough to go on. The reason HUD is encouraging us on this path is that the voucher-based platform, which is more what they're moving us towards, is less reliant on the congressional appropriations, and at least there's more commitment for it. The ability to leverage private capital can't be understated in terms of actually getting the funding to do the projects. And so Tucson House is an example of that, where yes, we will have a significant public funding commitment to rehabilitate it, but also being able to leverage that with private capital is really important. And then we will talk, I want to hear thoughts on the scattered sites portfolios and what it could look like. But we are aiming to sell a portion of that portfolio. We want to keep some of it. We want to make sure we're mindful of still having housing in areas of opportunity. We want to make sure that housing is served by transit and has other services around it. And we want to try to create affordable homeownership opportunities. So our dream would be to anyone we sell still be a homeownership opportunities for low-income families. And so those are some of the goals we're after. And I also mentioned both from reducing driving across the whole city, but also when we go to renovate, rehabilitate, and even when we go to turn into homeownership opportunities, I want to take that time to try to improve the units to really be more energy efficient, be more water efficient, and really help prepare for our climate future. This is an example that I may have Eric jump in, but this walks you through the increased revenue through two different repositioning tools and sort of what it would look like. So Eric, do you mind summarizing quickly?
Sure. One of the things we'll be talking about is using this a HUD tool called Section 18 to convert public housing to Section 8 housing at fair market rents. And basically what it's allowing a housing authority to do is to take advantage of the same benefits that private owners, private landlords use to operate housing. And so in this case, your scatter site portfolio for Silverbell. So Silverbell is a tax credit project that is roughly 20 years old. One of our recommendations is converted from public housing to Section 8 housing, which HUD allows you to do without any justification because it's scatter site. And that would increase the revenue at that project by 279%. Because that's the difference between HUD operating subsidy for public housing and what private landlords get under the Section 8 program. So that's one example. The other is MLK apartments, where we're proposing converting that from public housing to Section 8 housing under the RAD program. The RAD program is not as it's supposed to be, what's quote unquote revenue neutral. And so what you're doing is you're taking all of the revenue that would have gone to MLK as public housing and converting it into a voucher. And it's roughly the revenue that would be going to the project is about 19% higher, or about $120,000 more income a year, which would just help put MLK on a more solid financial footing. What you're instead of the housing authority receiving capital funds for the project for repairs, it's basically turned into a rent, which is what's shown here. And so that's just an example of using a straight RAD conversion of MLK to increase the revenue for that property.
One important piece there is the residents, the tenants at MLK won't see a difference in terms of what they're paying. And, you know, we'll still continue to operate it the same exact way. But that's just one important piece is for a MLK resident, it's not going to look any different, feel any different. It's our end where there'll be some changes in terms of that piece. I only have a couple more slides, and then I think more discussion will be helpful. So the report has tables of recommendations, and I summarize that, oversimplified it here, just that the strategies, the recommendations are broken out into short-term and mid-term, and that really it is project-specific. So whether it's a Craycroft Towers project or 50 scattered site single-family homes, each, we want to go through the process of evaluating those projects to really figure out how it works. And then really thinking through the financing tools and making sure we can move forward, and then having there be, as we talked about before, more of an approval process. So the ones that to me feel kind of where we want to go is, we are moving Tucson House. We know we're moving forward. Choice Neighborhoods, super grateful that we have a plan for rehabilitating the Tucson House and really giving the people that live there not only a much better housing product, but also wraparound services. Very excited about that. So the other three I do want to talk through. One is to initiate the repositioning process for MLK. And Eric can talk through that, but my understanding is, given the age and given that it doesn't need a major rehabilitation right now, it's a pretty straightforward process. And so feels like if we can be getting more revenue today, not today, after we go through this process, it feels like something that makes sense. It looks like, Eric, you want to jump in there?
Oh, I just, the the point of all of these is to HUD won't allow you to convert unless there's a plan for addressing the capital needs of the property over a 20-year period. And so a lot of the strategies are about preserving public housing. That's what we're, in the case of MLK, what HUD says is we'll allow you to convert from public housing to RAD as long as you can show that there's enough resources to cover all the identified capital needs over a 20-year period. Of the Housing Authority's portfolio, MLK is really the only property that might be a candidate for this, what's called a straight RAD conversion. In other words, we're not planning to do any work up front. We're just repositioning for the future. And likely MLK will go back and get tax credits in another, you know, 5-10 years to recapitalize itself again, to sort of, you know, replace old cabinets and appliances and HVAC systems and windows and so on. And so this is sort of an interim of just for the Housing Authority to dip its toes into the RAD water, and with the one property that we think is would be a good candidate for RAD conversion without renovation.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to get through. I think I have one more slide. So get through this, and then Jim, I'll let you facilitate from there. So the other two things that I want to initiate sooner than later, I mentioned Craycroft Towers. This is a site that I want to be working on how we renovate, rehabilitate. And so there's doing a capital needs assessment sooner than later. And really that will help determine what tools we could have. But that's an example where depending on the level of investment needed can help in terms of determine the tools. And that's where we can then look at some of the tax credit and the private resources to support that. So that's right. One that's fresh on my brain.
And we looked at that as it's a great candidate for a 9% tax credit application or a 4% bond application. It works financially well. And it is the largest multifamily in the scatter site portfolio. It's a good candidate for renovation as a standalone project. One of the things we observed was that the Housing Authority has no elderly preference housing right now. And so there are a number of projects like MLK, MLK, yes, like Tucson House and Craycroft Towers, that this would be an opportunity to, as while you're doing the renovation, to look at whether you need to create more housing that really very consciously promotes aging in place. So as you're doing the renovation, you're, planning for the future for those. But it was quite striking to us that the Housing Authority had no designated elderly housing. So all of these, and some of them are very good candidates as elderly housing, like Craycroft.
And then the final bullet here, I want to make sure as we move forward with the scattered sites, we are intentional, just like the intentionality that went into the original goal with them. I want to also be mindful. And so I want to, Eric's recommendation is to create a task force. I know one more group, but it's important to me that we have some stakeholder input into what this looks like. And so I would be asking this group to consider the prioritization criteria. So what does it make sense for the city of Tucson to keep as rentals? What makes sense in terms of trying to sell for affordable home ownership? And what is the ability, I want to try to sell as many as possible for affordable home ownership. And we know, and I'm sure Maggie and others can speak to this, it's hard to make those numbers work sometimes. So I also don't want to think that, if we try to sell half of it, that it will work for affordable home ownership as well. So I want others who do this work to help us. So the task force, the HCD staff, members of the commission, I would really appreciate, and then some external stakeholders who do more of this work on a basis to really create what that plan can be, to then go back to the Public Housing Board of Commissioners. And so that is the thinking there. And I am done with the presentation. And so, Jim, I'm happy to kind of turn it over to you to facilitate a discussion.
Great. Go ahead.
One question I had about the, when you say convert to Section 8 housing, would that be City of Tucson owned and having
yes.
people? Okay. So the Section 8 voucher money. So that
it's, goes to City of yeah. Tucson. And so this is not privatization. This is doing exactly what the Housing Authority has done in the past with its Hope 6 project. It's mm-hmm. so the land would continue to be owned by the Housing Authority. The Housing Authority would be in most of these cases would be the general partner to the tax credit partnership. It's just a different look for affordable housing, but it's not the Housing Authority giving up its responsibilities in any way.
Maybe two follow-up questions on that then is one is how that would impact the maintenance. Are you thinking just that because you'd be getting more money, that you'd be able to maintain more of those?
In some cases, yes. So it's for some of the scatter site, but HUD is encouraging housing authorities nationwide mm-hmm. to convert your scatter sites because it's mm-hmm. just, you're not getting enough money under public housing to operate scatter site housing. So just by tripling the revenue mm-hmm. for those units that the housing authority decides it wants to hold on to, it will then have enough money to hire managers and maintenance staff mm-hmm. and so on to operate it. And so financial stability is one of those criteria. Yes.
And my final question there is, would there be any different qualifications? Like if someone's living in public housing, it's converted to city owned Section 8, would they have to reapply? Is there an automatic rollover? What would that process be? Are there any different qualifications?
Yeah. So,
is there a chance that people get kicked off?
Under the RAD and Section 18 program, there's extraordinary amounts of tenant protections in place. In terms of notification, in terms of right to return, in terms of one of the features of if you are in project-based Section 8 housing, you automatically qualify for what's called choice mobility. So after you're a year in a property that's a Section 8 property, you can ask the housing authority, hey, I want a tenant-based voucher to go off into the private market, which is something as a public housing resident, you would have never been able to do. So what we found is that usually residents have been incredibly responsive to this because they're getting new fixed up housing. They're from their perspective, they're still paying 30% of their income towards rent. And there are all these other tenant protections and the opportunity of choice mobility. So there's a whole overlay of tenant rights and protections and, you know, benefits that we didn't talk about here, but I think is really important to the RAD program.
Okay, thanks. My hand came down, but I'm gonna say a couple things. So quick question before I talk. On those scattered housing sites, is there debt on those units, or are they owned free and clear for the most part?
There's no debt. Public housing can't have debt on it.
Okay.
So part of the, you know, the attraction of RAD and these other tools is like it's allowing housing authorities to borrow money with that new Section 8 revenue they have, but the scatter sites have no debt on them.
Okay. So I really like the idea of affordable for sale on those scattered housing, as long as you're able to maintain affordability over time when people sell their units to somebody else, that it maintains its affordability. And so I think working with a land trust or somebody like that's a really good idea. So on the surface, I like that. I think the city's going after RAD financing, choice neighborhoods, that type of stuff, that the sources that are not available to private developers is also a good strategy. You know, the biggest point of feedback I've heard from the development community about the city of Tucson getting into the housing business is that they are now competing with private development entities, both their for-profit and nonprofit. And so, you know, the issue with the city going after 9% is that it could drive away private developers from looking at deals in Tucson, and we don't want to do that, right? It could have it end up having a long-term negative impact on the amount of units built here if they feel like they can't compete with the city's own projects. So going after non-competitive sources, such as the 4%, I think would be the first, that would be the better option as opposed to trying to go on after 9%. So that's my feedback in general, but
Jim, I do want to jump in there, and I'm happy to talk to any developer in this community that has issues with us going after 9% or any development. If they can solve our affordable housing crisis on their own, then I say great. But given that we are trying to serve the the most low income that need a deep subsidy, I will continue to try to find whatever we can do to make these projects work. And I'm happy to talk to any developer that has issues with that.
Okay. Well, I'm happy to share that feedback with you offline, Ann. Okay. Okay, Jay.
Thanks, Jim. And thanks for the great presentation. I guess I was just sitting here thinking of the enormous irony of what we're talking about. We have this huge affordable housing crisis, and the solution is right in front of us, but there's no money for it. So we're getting rid of all the public housing. I mean, not getting rid of it, but it's just a shame that we are not, as a society, actually building more public housing, supporting it. But, you know, that's not what's happening. So I thought the irony was there. I also think that, you know, the way that the city has done their public housing is really as a model. I mean, you know, HUD is pushing for affirmatively furthering fair housing, right? Putting folks in high opportunity areas who might not otherwise be able to live there. The city has done a great job. I mean, Vicky, your comment about, you know, driving right past the house. I mean, that right there says it all. So it's just a real shame that you know, these types of projects are just, you know, not, there's just not enough money for them, because that's what we're choosing as society to do. Along those lines as well, you know, one of the things that concerns me just in general with the repositioning and just how we're dealing with public housing is, you know, over time, I think one of the great tragedies of, you know, redeveloping public housing over the years and all of the things that have happened is that people get displaced and end up losing housing. And, you know, it sounds like the city is being intentional about making sure that folks don't get displaced and that there's not misunderstanding and things of that nature. So I would just really encourage that, you know, whatever is done over time, that, you know, much care is paid to making sure that people don't kind of get lost in the shuffle and essentially lose their housing. Jim, I think your idea about, you know, talking about if the scattered site housing is going to be sold to, you know, try and make it available to, you know, first time home buyers using the land trust model, you know, whatever we can do to keep that affordable and to, you know, develop the city of Tucson and, you know, home ownership, I think is a great idea. I also understand about, you know, the environmental impacts of driving all over the place to deal with these scattered sites, but somebody's going to have to drive there, whether it's the city or not. So, you know, we have to drive everywhere. So I don't know how much of an offset it's really going to make environmentally for the city not to manage them. I mean, if you're hiring a handyman as a homeowner, that person's driving from across town anyway. So I just wanted to point that out. And I think you answered my question. I think through what Ray was asking, which is, I was just also curious about, you know, if the city would still kind of own property that was no longer public housing, but then, you know, was Section 8 based. And it sounds like it really is just kind of a different model, but the city is still essentially kind of in control of the property. So I think that that answered my question. I guess I was also wondering as well, is there a difference in how stable your housing is if you are a public housing resident versus a Section 8 recipient? You know, do you, is it more difficult to be evicted from public housing or to, you know, lose your privilege of public housing as compared to Section 8? I think that's an important thing because, you know, one of the things I think we're also supposed to be dealing with is housing stability. And I would want to make sure that, well, I don't know that it's possible, but, you know, that, you know, the Section 8 housing or the housing that people would be moving into or the transition that people wouldn't also be losing some type of stability. But, you know, if the program is the program, I guess there's not a whole lot to be done about it. So anyway, a lot of random thoughts there, but just wanted to share those.
The one thing in Eric, in terms of, if you think, I'm curious, the public housing versus Section 8, to me, it's less public housing versus Section 8 or city owned versus not city owned. So I think to me, we have our El Portal portfolio. We own and operate it very similarly, pretty much the same as we do our public housing. And so we do tend to try to work with our residents whenever we can to try to prevent evictions. And I think we have a lot more tolerance for trying to go through that process than somebody might in a private landlord. And so my instinct is not so much a difference between public housing versus Section 8, but more city versus non. But Eric, curious your answer there.
From a tenant perspective, they look and feel the same. You're paying 30% of your adjusted gross income for rent. I think there's some long-term policy issues about the Section 8 program is a less flexible program than public housing. So that, in other words, there's very specific occupancy standards. You can't have one person living in a four-bedroom unit. That's just because you can only collect a one-bedroom rent if you're, you know, if you're one person in a four-bedroom unit. And so there, if you become over income in Section 8, it's a different set of rules than if you become over income in public housing. So in other words, I think there's perhaps more of a safety net in public housing than there is in Section 8. And that's just an issue with the Section 8 program. In other words, I think it's over 6 months. If you're not receiving subsidy for more than 6 months, then the unit is no longer a Section 8 unit. And then once that person, they can continue to pay rent there, but if they lose their job, then they're not back on operating subsidy the way you would be in public housing. So it's just, it works differently. And that's just, you know, the differences between the programs. But, you know, one thing I did want to point out is that in other cities where we've seen scatter site work, there is some sort of, program by which people who move, households who move into scatter site units actually select to be there. And that's not the case in Tucson right now. It's first come, first serve. If you're next on the list, you get assigned to scatter site unit or you get assigned to, you know, a multifamily property. And there's not, whereas I think there is different expectations if you're living in a single family home versus if you're living at your Hope Six project, which is called La Posada. You know, where there's a property manager on site, there's a lot more support if you're living in a multifamily property than if you're living out in, you know, where there's a homeowners association, you're in a suburban area. And that's right now, there is no differentiation with how people get assigned to units. And so, you know, one might, in some places, we've seen the scatter site being used as sort of the privilege of once you've sort of proven yourself in other public housing sites, you qualify to live in the single family homes. And, you know, that might be something that would be one of the, you know, things you might want to do in looking at the operation of your scatter site units that you hold on to. And that follows on what Jim was talking about earlier about Mesa.
Yeah. All right. Hey, from a time perspective, guys, we've got about 47 minutes left in the meeting and we've got a lot to get through today. So I'm going to ask that we try to keep comments, let's make comments quickly here and wrap this up. So Kenny.
Yeah, thanks for sharing a lot of good information. I know it's a large set of data portfolio to be working with and presenting that menu of the things you're considering. So just appreciate all that work. I was wondering, to this three different comments. One, just like if the level of affordability and how the depth of AMI that could be addressed, if that impact was assessed for each of these options, to the point about private development, maybe that's a way of showing, that the levels that aren't being reached by the development community. And I'd just be curious to see if that changes, the AMI levels with these different options. And then for the scattered site portfolio, it's just wondering about the spatial analysis that might have been done on that. Thinking about, are there ways to geographically bundle some of these areas, like converting a unit to something that's like a management office to help distribute and create efficiencies, right? And so
that's a great idea. And one of the things we gave a database to the Housing Authority where we took a whole bunch of different scatter site databases, put them in one place and put the parcel numbers on them. And so the one thought would be that for this scatter site task force, they would use that as a tool for looking at geography as one of the factors. It's because we have age, we have, condition, et cetera, but geography could be one of those factors that you could look at.
Yeah, and depending on that weighting, right, you might be able to, you might get to a unit sooner than you would hope to, but it's along the way, it's creating an efficiency of management. So excited to hear about that. And then just to underscore, finding ways if units need to be sold, trying to pair that with limited equity, shared equity, covenants for affordability in future sales, just to see that it maintains that access. Thanks.
And sounds like we got our first volunteer for the task force.
Maggie?
And did you want to say anything about the Faircloth units? Because I think that's a really important part of this. And
I'll let you go for that, Eric. I think I appreciate you bringing that
all
up.
So all of the units in the public housing portfolio serve extremely low income. The whole point of Section 8 is that it'll serve a range of incomes. And so that basically you pay 30% of your income regardless of what your income is, up to typically there's a sort of a flat rent, a market rent that, would once your income is so high, it sort of maxes out at what the market rent would have been for that unit. But one of the things the Housing Authority has, how many Faircloth units? God, I'm sorry, I forgot.
417 or 421. Okay. It's a little over 400.
So there's an opportunity to take units. What the HUD has also been encouraging housing authorities to take operating subsidy that's been sitting on a shelf for Tucson, saying, hey, if you create more public housing, we'll provide you the operating subsidy up to those 470 units or so on. And so there's a number of recommendations about how to create more units to serve extremely low-income people. That's part of the recommendations. And that's something that the guy, Senator Faircloth, who created that law back in the 80s, did it as to penalize public housing, to sort of say no more than this many units can ever be public housing. And what HUD has been doing recently, saying, well, that's actually the minimum. We want everyone to go after taking all those units off the shelf and bringing them back online. So it's just one of the exciting things that we had been discussing with the Housing Authority of creating new units with rental subsidy.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions or comments on?
I just wanted to just say that I'm really, really glad that homeownership is part of this strategy. And one of the advantages of selling units to a homeowner is that, after rehab, those costs become, any continued rehab becomes the cost of a homeowner. So that burden is, now off. And I agree that, it should be long-term affordability, if not permanent affordability, with some shared equity component, just like which the land trust has. I don't know if this is the time or place, because we've had some discussions with Praxis and the HCD, but I would think that it would be kind of modeled with how we did the NSP unit somehow. And I guess that's something we can discuss later if we get any of those units to rehab. So, and so, and that's all. Thank you.
Joe, is it quick?
It's quick. A couple things. I would love to hear that presentation without the word repositioning, because it feels like a euphemism. And I think you'd get it would be a more clear presentation if we said what we mean. The other thing is referencing Faircloth. If I remember right, Faircloth was 1999. Tucson's Faircloth limit is 1,926 units. And if we're at 1,505, we're already down 22% from that. That's all.
And I appreciate not using reposition, but I don't know what other term to use. I'm intentionally in the report, you'll see a lot about disposition. And that's a term that I feel like is not clear in terms of what exactly that means. So I'm trying to not use that term. And so, you know, open to ideas there, because it is what I mean in terms of positioning it from public housing to Section 8. So open to ideas in terms of that terminology. So I don't know what else to use.
Okay, let's go ahead and move to agenda item number 5, which is the Housing First. And I'm embarrassed to admit, I don't remember what the follow-up questions were for this. And do you, is this kind of the
same? Thank you, Eric. And I'm happy, if it's easier, I'm happy to follow up with the Housing First subcommittee instead, if we want to skip this item for time. But I will say, the Housing First committee, based on the presentation from Brandy and Jason and Austin in the commission meeting before that, had specific questions for me, and I did get those answers, and I'm happy to follow up with them if that's helpful.
Unless there's any objections, I guess that's my preference, especially since Tisha's not here and she's the chair of that subcommittee. Does anybody object to pushing this down to that subcommittee before it comes back to the commission? Okay. All right, then let's go to agenda item number 6, which is the State Housing Conference recap. So the Arizona State Affordable Housing Conference was in Tucson 2 weeks ago. It was sold out again. I think there was 600 people or something who were in attendance. I think it was well attended. There's a lot of people, a lot of companies coming from out of state trying to figure out how to do affordable housing in Arizona, which is great. The other thing that happened right before the conference is they released the first draft of the qualified allocation plan. And if you guys remember, the qualified allocation plan is what the state uses to score and determine which projects will receive low-income housing tax credit awards. So I wanted to quickly go through some of the changes in the QAP. Can you guys, can you see my screen here?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So this is I'm just going to go through the selection criteria and kind of hit on the things that affect the city of Tucson. So as we've talked about before, projects are scored on points. It's a yearly process. The applications are typically due April 1st, and then the awards are typically made about 2.5 months. So April, May, like mid-June is typically when the awards come out. So let's see here. So I'm going to scroll down. We don't need to talk about developer experience and that type of stuff. So there is a lot of changes for rehab projects. They are putting an increased emphasis on preservation of existing affordable housing units, which is good. This one's number two is an interesting one because the higher the rehab. So basically what they're saying is if it's an extensive rehab, they want to go through the 9%. If it is a moderate rehab, go through the 4% program. So every project needs to do a minimum of 25,000 per unit rehab. And then the other thing that I thought was the significance here, and this is again for rehab projects specifically, is project-based rental assistance or housing vouchers. So if there's more than 46% of the units have housing vouchers, you get 40 points. So that ties in with the first criteria pretty well. This stuff we'll go through on the new construction side. So for new construction, there's not really any changes to developer experience, supportive housing. So if it's an 811, or if you have a minimum of 15% of the units, which will use rental assistance, housing vouchers, that will receive 30 points. Or if there's federal project-based vouchers on 30% of the units, that will receive 30 points. So they've continued to put an emphasis on the projects receiving housing vouchers. This, I think, might be an issue for the city of Tucson, because it's my understanding that that the city is out of housing vouchers. So if that's the case, it's going to be difficult to get more than one award this next year. Okay, so the proximity to amenities hasn't changed. This is just basically saying that projects need to be close to shopping and travel and that type of stuff. Not travel meaning city transportation, so bus services and things like that. If it's in a QCT, a DDA, a difficult development area, a qualified census tract, or if it's part of a community revitalization plan, it will receive 5 points for each of those for a maximum of 10 points. So I think that's pretty straightforward. The other thing that I really wanted to point out here, and this is directly impacting the city of Tucson, is local support. So they changed local support from 15 points to 30 points. And so what they're basically asking for is 10, they can get 10 points if the city will put in a minimum of 500,000 per project. They'll get 10 points if it's in a federal historic rehab tax credit. So if you can get historic tax credits, that's worth 10. That's a pretty difficult one to get, especially on new construction. And this other one is there's 10 points if there's a land lease agreement with the city. So the city owns the land, they lease it back to a private developer, that's worth 10 points. So the short of it is here that the city needs to continue to put in housing vouchers and money into these projects. And if there's could be a land lease back agreement, that's almost going to assure an award. The other thing I think that's of significance is that the zip code penalty has gone away, which is a good thing, because the 85705, which is right here, is no longer a deterrent. So that was a major problem that we had with the last QAP. So I know I ran through that pretty quickly, but is there any comments or questions on that? Mindy?
Did we get, will there be copies of that report posted to the website?
It's on the website.
It is. Okay, great. Thank you.
Hey, Anne, a question. Are you or is HCD planning on providing written comments to ADOH, and is there anything that we as a commission can do to help?
We are. We've had one conversation with them, but absolutely told them we would follow up with a written letter. I have a few concerns based on the draft QAP, but our big one is the project-based voucher requirement. You know, we feel like we'll try to do what we can to make the local funding part, but we are really at a position where it's going to be really difficult to commit the 30% project-based vouchers to the projects. So that's my biggest concern. And I have to imagine other PHAs are in that same boat. So that's our big concern is just given how many vouchers we have and how they're being used, we're at budget capacity. So right now we have to be really careful about our vouchers.
So I've got a question for you. Is there, you know, we had a presentation a couple of years ago when we were talking about the source of income ordinance, and there was roughly 800 housing vouchers that were not being used because they couldn't find somebody that would accept them. Is there any way to recycle those, or, you know, if they're not used, to reallocate them to a project and then give those people who had them like first dibs? Or is that not legal?
That based one is I would like to get updated numbers on what that looks like. And so, and I see Terry has been on the attendee or on the other tab, that he may have more information than I do there, but I recommend we give you updated numbers there, but we can't just take a voucher from somebody and give it towards for a project-based voucher.
Okay, so comments are due here, I think, in the next couple of weeks. If there is anything as a commission that we can do to help, please let us know. We're willing to also put in our 2 cents. But I want to make sure the city stays competitive in the program. So if you recall, one of the changes that was made last year is Maricopa County and Pima County have to split the first two awards between the two counties. So if the highest scoring project is in Maricopa County, then this next urban project awarded is automatically going to come to Pima County. But then after that, it just goes to the highest award. So if Tucson does absolutely nothing, we're guaranteed one project a year. But obviously we want more than that. So okay, any other comments or questions before we move to the board retreat and facilitator conversation? Okay, so agenda item number 7 is the discussion on the board retreat and facilitator. So on the website was posted a proposal from Southwest Decision Resources. This is a city-approved vendor for facilitation. I can share my screen here. Okay. So this is what they are proposing that we do in the strategic planning meetings. So essentially what they would like to do is they're going to attend 2 full commission meetings as well as the subcommittee meetings. They want to meet with each of the subcommittee chairs individually to kind of, before a retreat, put together, I guess, get an understanding of what we're doing and then and put together materials for a retreat. They'd like to facilitate a half-day retreat in person. So it's going to take 2 commission meetings, which would be, if we can get this approved here in the next month, It would be our October and November meeting. And then so sometime in December, we could do a half day retreat. And then there'll be a follow up probably January and February with the full commission to basically reestablish goals and objectives of the commission. So their budget estimate for this is $9,753. They're anticipating it to take about 68 hours of time. So I don't really understand, Anne, what we need to do to get this approved. Is this something that HCD can help us with? And
I mean, so HCD is committed to the funding to support it. And, you know, right now, today, we have to use, for a few different reasons, we feel like it will be easiest to use somebody who's on a city contract. I know, Jay, I do want to say that for an FYI moving forward, we're actually going to be soon opening up a procurement to be able to add vendors that can do this type of service. And I think Jason Thorpe is on. He can talk more about that. So I know that some folks had hoped to use other people. Today, they're not on the city vendor contract list, but we are hoping that in the future, there will be some more options as well. So I think if the commission is happy with Southwest Decision Resources, I think it's more a matter of fleshing out the scope. And we'll do what we need to do on our end to get it approved in time for a retreat.
Okay, so I would like to ask the commission members if there's any suggestions on the on adjustments to the scope, and if not, can we get a motion from somebody to recommend acceptance of this proposal? Mindy?
I think December is a very busy month for people and would suggest January as a month that might be more convenient.
I agree. And I actually think that works with this because they're planning on going through March of 24. So I think I misspoke because we did talk about that, about doing the retreat in January.
The other comment is, holy shit, that's a lot of money.
Any other comments? Okay, well, I guess the question then to the commissioners is this something that we want to accept? And is there somebody willing to make a motion to recommend that we accept this proposal?
Jim, I'll make a motion to accept the proposal.
Okay, thank you, Jay. Is there a second?
I second that.
Thank you, Mindy. Okay, so Jay has made a motion that we recommend acceptance of this proposal from Southwest Decision Resources. Any other comments before we put it to vote? Okay, let's go ahead and put it to vote then. Maggie?
I approve.
Wendy? Oh, Wendy's not here. Mindy?
Approve.
Vicki?
Approve.
Lori?
Approve.
Ray?
Yes.
Kenny?
Yes.
And Jay?
Aye.
Okay, the motion carries. Thank you, everybody. Okay, so agenda item number 8 is the asset repositioning of public housing, and it's a discussion that's going to be led by Ray.
Thank you. I'm not sure if everyone got a chance to read this article, it's a chapter from After the Projects. It was on this month's the agenda for this month's meeting with all the other links. I received this article from staff at HCD and want to start with just appreciation that HCD is taking into consideration not only kind of the logistics and the asset planning, words with lots of acronyms, but also the lived experiences of people who will be impacted by this. I think really digesting this information is an important part of having the conversation about changes in public housing. Some of the main things that stood out to me in this article, one was a quote of, even when city officials believe themselves to be well-meaning, this did not always mean that residents believed all promises had been fulfilled. And I think about the lived impact that happens when people's housing has changed. It's not just a matter, right, of, okay, moving from a single family home, one-to-one replacement, no one is displaced, they say, but in the experience of the history of public housing in Tucson, this actually explicitly runs through times where people said, like, I would rather stay in a home that feels substandard to like some city official of what substandard means, or like some an official policy of what substandard means. And then they've talked about some people decided to stay in homes that the city called, quote, substandard, rather than move into multifamily housing because they wanted a yard for their kids to play in, wanted a clothesline, wanted to live less under the microscope of the city, that would happen more in the multifamily housing. Another aspect shared in this article is the experience of what it was like to live through construction and to live through the process of a building being rehabilitated. Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Did you say this article is on the website? I've been looking for it. I've been having a hard time finding it.
Yeah, the article's on the commission website.
What's the title?
It's called After the Projects.
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. So maybe I could do a open up. I know many people have, at least some people in the room have read the article. I'm going to give a chance if anyone wanted to share about it, and maybe we could discuss it further after more people have had a chance to. Does it sound? Did anyone get a chance to read this, or have they read it before and have any reflections, or any HCD staff who've already been digesting this and in conversation of how, not just the article, but the lived experience? I think this is just like, it's not about an article, right? It's about like people in our community who still live here today, who have that lived experience of what has happened in shifts in public housing. I see Jay, you have your hand raised.
Yeah, I did not get a chance to read the article, but look forward to reading it. But I just really appreciate you bringing this aspect up, because, you know, if anybody knows about, you know, the history of public housing over the years, people have often been forgotten, even though it's, you know, about housing people. So making sure that, you know, as this happens, you know, these things that obviously need to happen and will happen with public housing and the repositioning, making sure that we, you know, at the very least limit the damage and trauma to people and families living in, you know, public housing and other subsidized housing is limited as best as possible. So I just wanted to thank you for bringing that up. And I hope that we as a commission can keep our eye on this and provide guidance as this transpires over time.
Yeah, Anne, do you want to share?
I'm happy to go after Joe.
Sorry, I didn't see you, Joe.
Oh, no, it's okay. I read After the Projects and one of Lawrence Biddle's other books a couple years ago. And I wanted to really echo Jay and say I'm glad that that HCD is interested in this and taking up a reading group and looking into those, the kind of knowledge base that really exists, especially from, you know, Vail's got like 6 books that are just about public housing. So, but yeah, the wealth of knowledge that exists around this, I really appreciate that. Thank you for putting it on the agenda, Ray.
And I'll just say I also appreciate, Ray, you putting it on the agenda. And Housing and Community Development has a book club to be able to try to better understand all the work we're doing. And so we did talk about it at a meeting a couple of weeks ago, but there was enough, and I wasn't able to make it, but my understanding, and Neto or anyone can jump in, there was enough discussion, enough interest that we're going to do it again. And on Tuesday, September 26th, there will be, HCD staff will again have a discussion, and we've invited Corky Poster to join, since he's referenced a lot in the book about Posadas and what that project was. So, and it's at our main offices, HCD, Tuesday, September 26th at noon. If you are interested, please just email Ernesto, just in case we get a more than, I can't imagine we'll get more than a quorum, but just in case, so we can manage that. But yeah, definitely something, not only when we're talking about asset repositioning, but we have a project really close to Posadas. You know, we will be developing we're looking to develop a 12.3 acre site that's really close. And so really feel like the lessons learned and discussions from that book hopefully will really help guide us for this other project. So thank you, Ray.
I'd also add, if you're looking for community members who are involved with that, I remember Angie Quiroz has mentioned in that those chapters as well.
Maybe since many people haven't had a chance to read it yet, we could put it on a future agenda and perhaps even invite people who live in Tucson now who are were a part of that organizing, whether they lived in public housing or were working in public housing during those transitions.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Mindy.
Yeah, thank you, Jim. I have not had a chance, did not read the article. I have it up. I need to print it out to read. So I would love to revisit in the next meeting. That's just what I think.
Okay.
Thank you for holding space for this. And yeah, I think it'll be a much more meaningful discussion after we've really had a time to digest it together.
Okay. Thank you. We all have our homework assignments in for the next meeting. Thank you, Ray. Okay, next agenda item number 10 is the U of A call for community projects. Kenny?
Hi, thanks for that, Ray, as well. I just wanted to share that, you know, we have a master's in science urban planning program at the U of A currently. Well, every year the students do a capstone project in teams that test out all the skills that they've learned through the program and curriculum. And currently there's a call for projects that may be suitable. So if there's anybody out there in the community, it doesn't have to be limited to housing, but this is a chance to get a group of graduate students to put their heads together with faculty guidance on questions. So community members that are submitting projects, they'd be the client for the student team. And I think you know, Jay had shared the Tucson Housing Equity Study. It would be a similar process to that, getting focus attention on a project. So that call at a little more description is on the agenda meeting website. And I also wanted to share that the Drachman Institute, the community partnerships and outreach arm of the university, is also having a call for projects that's open a little bit later till October. And that's, it's a little more matchmaking with faculty expertise. So, you know, we go through and sort the different projects that are proposed. And that's a little more flexible in terms of what kind of arrangements are there. So just wanted to take a quick minute to share that there's some opportunities just from the university and partnerships.
Kenny, this is a yearly thing that the U of A does, is that right?
Yeah, so for the planning capstones, I should have mentioned, they conduct the work within a semester in the spring. So the call now is to sort of get a scope of work, you know, figure out with a potential client, what the engagement would look like. And because there's a lot of different concentrations within the planning program, we try to make sure, and I was involved with this last year, make sure that, the different skills, the interests that students have are represented across different projects. And that happens every year. The Drachman call for projects, it will be an annual process as well. But we're testing out a new system for calling for projects. So, we did the first run last year and wanted to share the call now.
What project received the award last year?
There's a few different ones. I can't recall immediately. There's, I think, one more focused on landscape architecture and design. And I forget what the other few, but there was about four projects. There's a funding request as part of that with the Institute. With applications, we can negotiate that, I think, through the intake process.
Okay. Any other comments or questions for Kenny? Okay, thank you, Kenny. Let's move on to subcommittee updates. Tisha is out. Is there anybody who can give an update on Housing First?
Anne?
Oh, I will. I was at their last meeting and we talked through, in particular, questions and sort of concerns that have come up in the last few meetings. And I think, and Mindy, please jump in here. I thought it was a really helpful discussion. I think there was in particular concern around rules and regulations around our Housing First shelter. So that's where I was asked to follow up on sort of what it looks like and really making sure that they are low barrier shelters. And so we'll have that conversation at the next meeting in terms of what I learned regarding those items. And I thought overall it was a good discussion. I think, like probably many, still sort of trying to figure out what the main goals of this particular subcommittee will be. But I think my sense, and Mindy again, is just looking forward to the retreat to help clarify those things. But it was a good meeting.
Okay, thank you, Anne. Any questions for Anne? Okay, housing desegregation, Jay.
Thanks, Jim. So we had a good meeting. I think if I could summarize our meeting, we're feeling frustration at the limited or not really making much progress on measuring equity and really kind of defining what that means. And we actually, because we have worked to get the equity study completed that the ASU students did, that we shared with the commission, obviously, we have decided that we are not going to continue to meet until after the strategic planning process, because we kind of are out of ideas and have presented, I think, what it is that we think needs to be done. So at this point, just so everyone knows, we will not be meeting, like I said, again until after the strategic planning process is completed. So Vicky or Lori, is there anything that I missed or y'all would like to add?
I think you covered it. Thank you, Jay.
Can I make a friendly suggestion that maybe once the strategic planning process begins, if the facilitators want to meet with the subcommittee, that you guys have those meetings that kind of talk about goal setting and whatnot?
We'll think about it. No, I'm just kidding. Of course, we'll do that.
Okay. Thanks. Any other comments or questions for Jay? Kenny?
Thanks. And just thinking about, the proposal we just looked at, I think for me, it kind of expresses the urgency of getting that process started. December, I know it's busy, but if there's any way to kind of initiate that earlier or get through that process sooner. So the sense of direction is clear and there's, energy behind it.
I agree with Kenny. Every month is busy, if you ask me, so.
Yeah, I'll follow up with HCD after this meeting and figure out what we need to do to get the facilitator started. Okay, affordable housing, Shay is out. So I will give the update. I'm going to share my screen here. So we had a deliverable. So can you guys see this? The Word document. Okay, so
yes,
the biggest thing that the Affordable Housing Commission has been working on the last 2 months is establishing an affordable housing goal for the city of Tucson. So this is basically a summary of the presentations and the things that have been discussed. So the first graph is really just a snapshot from the low-income housing, the National Low-Income Housing Coalition's website. For the state of Arizona, there are 180,000 households which are extremely low income. We have a shortage in the state of 136,000 rental units for those extremely low renters. And then this has the income levels and things like that. When you start looking at the city of Tucson, currently we have a deficit of 26,085 units within the city for extremely low income renters. When you look at the 50% area median income, that number grows to 29,703. So we know what the deficit is and what needs to be done. When we look at what's currently available, so in the presentation we heard earlier, these numbers sound like they've changed a little bit. So this, according to the presentation we had received from the city, there was 1,489 City of Tucson owned units. I think the number that was thrown out earlier was 1,505. So there's a 16 unit discrepancy between this presentation and the one we got earlier, but it's in the ballpark. We have 4,996 Section 8 units. There's 94 currently that we're aware of home ownership that are affordable. A lot of these are through the land trust. And then the other sources, which include, I should probably say other, which include LIHTC and HUD 202, there's 4,341. So adding all those up, that's 10,920 affordable housing units within the city of Tucson. Of those 10,920, there are 1,882 units that are at risk of falling out of affordability. So that means that their compliance periods are coming up here in the next 5 years. And, you know, at least for those that are with private developers, if they want to pull them out of affordability, they have the ability to do that. In terms of number of units which are in the pipeline, so these are projects that are either under construction or they've received funding commitments, either 9% or 4% or state tax credits. There's 1,192 units that are in the development pipeline currently. So if we look at 2025, the assumption here for 2025 is that all of the units in the pipeline will be complete and in the market, and that nothing is going to fall out of the affordability. So that's the assumption that the subcommittee made. So using this as a starting point of setting our goal for 2030 on what we think, what we'd like to see in the city by 2030. So the process that we looked at is these numbers were initially much lower. And the subcommittee felt like we should be trying to set a more of a stretch goal. And I think this is something we don't have to vote on today. We're running out of time, but this is what the subcommittee originally came back to, wanted to present to the commission. So The goal would be to have 3 9% LIHTC projects per year with an average unit count of 75 each. These would be new construction. That would convert into 225 units. To do 2 4% LIHTC projects per year with an average unit count of 200. So these target more of that 50 to 80% AMI range, not the extremely low income, but that would provide 400 units per year. If we could, so this home ownership is a bit of a stretch goal, given that we think that there's, you know, all we know of right now is about 94 in the city. So adding 50 per year, I think, is a stretch goal. And then 80 with all the other sources of financing that are outside of LIHTC. So if we can average these numbers, which is a lot, that would add 775 per year. So our current stock is 10,920. We know there's 1,192 under development. We've assumed that of the 1,882 units that are at risk of falling out, we've assumed that 250 of those will, but then we want to add the 775 per year for the next 5 years. So this would be starting in 2024, 25, 26, 27, and 28, so that if the project is financed in 28, it can be placed in service by the end of 2030. Based on that, that would provide 15,637 units within the city, which would roughly fulfill 10% of our deficit. So what this is saying is, this is a stretch goal. This is what we think is likely going to be the best we can do. And it's going to require the city participation from the city between $15 to $50 million in order to hit this goal. So it's going to translate into total development costs of about $1.4 billion, and it's going to require the city to put in $15 to $50 million to achieve this goal, and it's going to meet about 10% of the current deficit. So a housing bond initiative would make a significant contribution to developing the affordable housing and filling this gap. So I will list a couple of sources here. What I'm going to suggest, because we're running short on time at 6 o'clock, is that if you have comments, please, I mean, if there's anybody that has comments right now, feel free to let me know. But if you've got additional comments, please send them to me or send them to Shay and I. And we will probably beat this up one more time in the subcommittee. And then we'd like to bring it back to the overall commission to provide as a recommendation for the city. So is there any comments or questions on this? Does it make sense? Is it understanding?
Yeah, it makes sense. Just a lot to digest. Okay,
any other comments or questions?
I think that Kenny, there's a question out there. Do we need to vote for the subcommittee selections?
Sorry, that's for, I think, the other agenda item. But on this point, just curious what, our HCD colleagues might, what their feedback might be. Because I think we discussed quite a bit about, the stretch goal, something more readily attainable, and trying to figure out ways of accounting for sustaining and preserving units.
Yeah, I think the biggest point of contention within the subcommittee is, do we want to do a stretch goal, or do we want to do something that we think is more attainable. Originally, this was two projects per year, and this was one project per year, and these numbers were both lower. So we started out closer to 500 units per year, and I do think that that is obtainable. This is going to be hard to do year after year over the next 5 years.
Jim,
said there's one thing. There's one other thing I want to just point out is federally, there is a bill going through Congress right now called the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act. They tried to get it through last year, and they didn't have the support to get it done at that point. This year, they're taking a little bit different approach, and they're only bringing on Democratic sponsors when a Republican signs up. So they're keeping it bipartisan, and it's getting much better support. So they've got roughly two-thirds of the votes that are needed right now to get this passed. If it passes, it's going to, what it's going to do is it's going to increase the tax credit allocation by 50%.
Jim, I need to bring up that we do not have quorum.
Uh-oh. Who left?
Vicky.
No, Lori and...
Lori
and Jay had to drop off at 6 o'clock, so we're down to six commissioners, Jim.
Okay, then we need to... And we need to bring this to adjournment.
Yeah. Sorry.
No, I appreciate you telling me. Thank you. So everybody, have a great rest of your month, and we'll be talking soon.
Bye.
Thank you, everyone.